All right, everyone. This is the, like I said, the last session on today's agenda, exam findings and observations as it relates to swaps. And my colleagues, Corey Little and Zila Breitman, here to take us home. So you guys go away.
Thanks, Joe. Welcome to today's final session, and thank you for sticking with us to the end. My name's Corey Little. I'm an exam manager with 9.5 years of experience.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Zila Breitman, also an exam manager in the swaps department.
So in this session, we're going to discuss some common swap exam findings from the past year, along with some observations. But first, wanted to talk a bit how our exams are risk-based and what exactly that means. So we take the information from firm filings, from past exam findings. We take a look at rule areas that haven't been tested at that firm for a time, and that's what we use to determine our risk-based scope. Important to note as well that a scope isn't set in stone at the start of an exam, but rather scope can change. Both rule areas can be scoped out if they're not really applicable or high risk for the firm, but also we'll scope in if we find something during the exam.
However, there are some rule areas due to heightened risk that we tend to look at in majority of our examinations. So for the past 18 months, the rule areas that we've been looking at frequently include market practices, certain elements of the risk management program, cybersecurity, as well as the more recent interpretive notices or newer updated rule areas. So areas like capital, third-party service providers, and swap data reporting. So with that in mind, we can take a look at the rules where we have more findings from our exams. These include business conduct standards, swap data reporting, portfolio reconciliation, once again, supervision, in case we didn't hear enough about that in the last panel. And then lastly, capital. So for capital, it's not necessarily an update on common findings, but just an important reminder that we want to highlight with you all. So we'll circle back to that. So Corey will get us started with business conduct standards.
Right, so our source for, I guess our most common source for findings are business conduct standard rule areas, and wanted to share a couple of observations first. So here, business conduct standards cover such a broad range of regulatory requirements. So it covers onboarding and disclosures, pre-trade disclosures, anti-fraud provisions, anti-manipulation. So very broad, but there's an important through line for all of these rules, which is 23402A. And that's the rule that requires swap dealers to develop policies and procedures to ensure compliance. So it's a frequent source of rule cites, and again, provides that through line for all of the business conduct standards. Moving to know your customers. So here, to comply with these onboarding requirements, firms' onboarding processes should include a couple of key elements. Here first, when the counterparty comes in the door, there needs to be a classification process. So what category does the counterparty fall into? So for our non-US swap dealers, that could be whether the counterparty is a US counterparty or non-US. Is the counterparty another swap dealer or a financial end user? Is a counterparty a special entity? So this is a vital first step. Second, we hope to see a process where red flags are identified. So anything in a counterparty's representation that doesn't make sense or that could indicate they may have elected the wrong counterparty category, we need someone to do that sanity check to make sure there's no red flags. So an example here, a counterparty who has elected that they are not a special entity, but if they have a name like the Cook County Pension Plan, that's something that's going to jump out at us and we'll think you dropped the ball there. Moving to the disclosures piece of the onboarding process. So if our member firms haven't already, we expect there to be a process for mapping the counterparty classifications to the swap dealers' required disclosures and protocols. And those have changed since Dodd-Frank rolled out, especially with the rollout of the initial margin rules. And then the final piece we expect to see in an onboarding process is a hard stop that's going to keep APs from trading with swaps counterparties prior to all of the onboarding documentation being completed. Now, switching gears to transaction-specific disclosure, so talking about pre-trade marks here. So here, what we're looking for firms, our best firms, are ensuring compliance by conducting trade reconstructions. So this includes, one, a verification that the records are there, but also a verification that the pre-trade mark was given. This is a manually intensive process, understood, because it does involve reviewing those communications, but it's what we see as a best practice. We also are seeing some firms, depending on how much latitude salespeople have with setting the pre-trade marks, we're seeing some of our firms actually check to make sure that the pre-trade mark provided was accurate. And then finally, we have the rule that prohibits against fraud, manipulation, and abusive trading practices, but Zeal is going to cover that a bit later. So hopefully, given some of the best practices I described before, if those best practices aren't implemented, I think the exceptions kind of flow naturally. So for KYC, that's misclassified counterparties, ignoring red flags in representations, and trading prior to all required relationship documentation being obtained. So an area of focus for our exam teams now is two counterparty categories, that's special entities and financial end users. Special entities are of particular concern, hopefully for obvious reasons, but financial end users being misidentified are another area of focus because of the potential knock-on effects that could have for exchanging initial margin. And this is low-hanging fruit for our exam teams because oftentimes we can look at a counterparty list and see whether a counterparty may have been misclassified. Also, a note for non-US swap dealers, we're taking a similar approach for looking for counterparties that may have names that or other indications that they may be US counterparties and have been misidentified. So switching to pre-trade marks, failure to deliver pre-trade mark was a very common exam finding. A theme here was it seems that voice-executed swaps transactions are more likely to miss that pre-trade mark, or the salespeople are missing it more there. Also an element here that it may be more difficult for our firms to determine whether a pre-trade mark has been given on those voice calls just because the trade reconstruction process is more manual there. And then a final and broader note here, if our sample testing reveals a failure to deliver a pre-trade mark or a single other kind of one-off item, we'll give you a cite to that particular regulation probably. If we determine that there are broader concerns such that the firm's processes and procedures aren't such that they're ensuring compliance, that's when we're going to reference the 23402A, that broader provision. And with that, I'll turn it over to Zila to round out business conduct standards.
Okay, thank you, Corey. So as I mentioned earlier, there are some areas that are more likely to be covered on our examinations, and a very popular one is market practices. So regardless of a firm's risk profile, we are likely to cover some aspect of market practices on just about every exam. So as Corey mentioned, this branches out of the business conduct standards regulations, which have a prohibition on fraud, manipulation, and other abusive practices. So most of the time, this will include the review of a firm's surveillance processes. And as most of our firms have been registered for a number of years now, and technology solutions have improved over time, we do expect that surveillance capabilities continue to enhance over time as well. It's imperative that surveillance capabilities are established for all in-scope products that a firm trades and that they cover all swap-associated persons. So these processes are often set up globally to ensure the same coverage, to cover all swap APs and to ingest data across the firm. However, we are still seeing firms who have gaps in certain asset classes. So for example, they may not be including all of their products, or they fail to ensure that all of their swap APs are being monitored. Another thing to keep in mind when thinking about surveillance is monitoring for different languages. So if you're a global firm and you're allowing your associated persons to conduct activity in different languages, you need to ensure that you have surveillance capabilities to monitor all of those languages. And this applies both for written and verbal communications, or else we would view that to be a gap in your surveillance program. When thinking about the volume of communications that a firm reviews, there are a couple of different factors that should be considered. So one is the volume of trading, and two would be the history of problems for a particular desk or an AP. So depending on the size and scope of a firm's operations, it may be necessary to use automated tools. So if there's high volume, you would lean towards automated tools to review communications. Or if you're a firm with lower volume, it may be possible to use manual tools. So this would include conducting spot checks, sampling, or using keyword searches to identify problematic communications. Where possible, a person independent from the sales and trading area should be conducting these reviews. And firms cannot be relying solely on a trader supervisor conducting their real-time surveillance in order to meet this type of requirement. Regardless of the exact method that your firm is using, whether it's automated or manual, we just want to remind that no matter what types of reviews are being done, they have to be documented, and the escalation of any types of follow-ups need to be documented as well, because these are things that we likely request as part of our examinations. Another thing to think about, if you're not using automated review, if it's not conducive for the type of surveillance that you're doing, and you're electing to do manual, the sample size needs to be reasonable. If you're a large firm with high volume, it's not sufficient to pick a small sample size and present that as part of your surveillance process. Another focus lately has been on the use of unauthorized means of communications. I'm sure everyone hears a lot about that, whether it be unauthorized devices or unapproved channels of communication. A best practice that we see to identify these types of unauthorized communications is to routinely conduct trade reconstructions. So this involves reconstructing pre-trade communications for a trade to identify an instance of an absence of certain verbal or written communication that would be necessary to support the trade. That would indicate that the individual either used an unauthorized device or potentially that the firm failed to maintain the required records. As part of our surveillance reviews, we often leverage data that the firms provide as part of our trade data request. It's really important that this data is accurate because we use it for a number of different testing strategies as part of our exams. Recently, we've also been often requesting certain e-communications data, and these requests are really dependent on specific facts and circumstances. So it could potentially be a request pertaining to one specific swap AP or one specific trade or a particular time period. It's just important to keep in mind that CFTC Regulation 23202 requires swap dealers to make and keep daily trading records of all the swaps that it executes, and also to make and keep pre-execution trade information that leads to the execution of a swap. So keep in mind that you will likely have to provide these types of records as part of our routine examinations. Overall, our view is that surveillance is really a key supervisory tool, and I will circle back once again to supervision at the end of the session. And now Corey will continue the discussion with SDR reporting.
Thanks, Zila. So I don't think it's a surprise in 2022, exam teams continue to raise issues related to swap data reporting. So here, cover the gamut from late reporting, incomplete reporting, and inaccurate reporting. We have seen improvements over time, but exceptions are still occurring and continue to require our firm's attention. On a bright note, NFA expects the newly effective rules and the reconciliation processes to reduce completeness and accuracy issues over time, hoping that these will identify things like trade mapping issues, reference data issues, trade feed issues that our testing will uncover, hoping the reconciliation process will uncover those sooner rather than later. Firms also need to be aware that system outages, which give rise to reporting incidents, are something we're keeping an eye on. Outages happen, but depending on how quickly the firm worked to remediate the effects of the outage and how frequently these outages occur, that's how higher risk we'll be putting on those violations. Late reporting can result both from systemic problems, but also manual problems. So focusing on the manual aspect, we mean here that APs are not booking the actual execution time of the trade, but rather just booking the time that they enter the trade into the trading system. And we've seen gaps here, sometimes significant, in between trade execution, when the trade's agreed to, and then the trade getting booked. So firms, again, are going to need to be looking to pre-trade communications to compare the actual time the trade was executed to the time it was booked. And now, moving to perhaps the biggest change of the newly effective rule regime, the updated treatment of errors and omissions, so both the reconciliation process and the reporting. So it breaks down into three key components for us. First, verification. Firms must reconcile the information reported to the SDR with their internal books and records. The rule specifies that all swap data for open positions must be reconciled. Historically, some firms were conducting this reconciliation, but focusing only on a few material terms. The rule specifies every trade data every trade data field required to be reported must be reconciled. So that's verification. Correction: firms must correct identified errors and omissions as soon as technologically practicable, or within 7 days. And that's regardless of whether the swap may have even expired during that time. And then the last element here is the reporting, which if a firm fails to correct errors within the time frame, they must notify DMO and provide an initial assessment of the error and initial remediation plan. And that notification is required within 12 hours. And as you can guess, this is going to be an area of focus for our exams this year. It already is. But now I will turn it over to Zila for the capital finding update.
So like I mentioned, this is by no means a complete update on capital. We do plan to have a separate update on capital at a future date once we have done more examinations in this area. But there is one concept that we wanted to mention again. We highlighted it earlier this year in a reminder that we sent out to our swap dealers. And this pertains to the concept of applying capital rules at the entity level. So swap dealers that are subject to CFTC minimum capital requirements must determine regulatory capital and minimum capital requirements at the legal entity level. So in other words, if you're a swap dealer adopting the bank-based approach, you must maintain regulatory capital as defined under the bank holding company regulations, as if the swap dealer itself were a bank holding company. If you're a swap dealer adopting the net liquid assets approach, you must maintain regulatory capital as defined under the SEC regulations, as if the swap dealer itself were a security-based swap dealer. In addition, where internal models are being used to determine regulatory capital or minimum capital requirements, the swap dealer must be able to demonstrate independent model validation and ongoing performance monitoring on the swap dealer's own use of the internal models at the legal entity level. So we wanted to remind firms of these requirements, and if you have any questions on your firm specifically in this area, feel free to reach out to your risk contact at NFA. Next, we will discuss portfolio reconciliation. Corey?
Thanks, Zila. So portfolio reconciliation has been a continued source for findings over the past year. Again, the rules require swap dealers to engage in portfolio reconciliation to identify and resolve discrepancies on the material terms of the swap. The rule requirements are different, swap dealer to swap dealer reconciliation versus swap dealer to non-swap dealer. But I'll start with the swap dealer to swap dealer reconciliation, so, as it's the more common source of findings. So one, here again, all material terms must be reconciled. Again, swap dealers have been doing portfolio reconciliation since before Dodd-Frank, but Dodd-Frank has made the reconciliations more stringent. And this is where we're seeing the issues. Again, all material terms must be reconciled. So that's going to include things like LEI, unique product identifier, unique swap identifier numbers, valuations, et cetera. Now, swap dealers have either not been prioritizing these terms or they're still working through to build their programs out to get that full material term reconciliation. Another common finding is with respect to valuation discrepancies. So here the rules define valuation discrepancy as 10% or greater valuation difference between counterparties. However, we've seen swap dealers set thresholds other than 10% or include a dollar threshold in addition to the 10%. So that's been a common source of findings. Now, with respect to swap dealer to non-swap dealer reconciliation, the rules are less stringent. You can't force a counterparty to engage in a reconciliation, but we still have some expectations for our firm. So they must establish written policies and procedures for engaging in portfolio reconciliation and agreeing to any changes with the counterparty if they're raised. We've seen firms not engaging or not essentially taking this area seriously, relying upon maybe a customer statement to fulfill those requirements. But it's important that if a firm is going to rely upon a regularly produced statement, business as usual, that they are informing their counterparties that that's the source that they're relying upon for portfolio reconciliation and to fulfill that requirement. So now Zila will bring us home on supervision.
Okay, where are we? Like number 2000 at this point? Okay. supervision. So CFTC and NFA rules require swap dealers to diligently supervise their employees and agents in the conduct of their swaps business. So a strong supervisory framework is really important and includes both implementing policies and procedures that will allow a firm to comply and also monitoring activities for those compliance. So we've raised a number of supervisory concerns in the past, and these can be raised either because we identify rule violations across multiple areas or because of one significant rule violation. Repeat findings can also indicate ineffective supervision. So the first line of defense lies with employees in the front line. So this would include sales and trading, also operations staff and their supervisors. So they are primarily responsible for compliance. However, compliance personnel play a key role in this as well, as they're tasked with monitoring a firm's compliance with these regulations. So we just wanted to run through a couple of different ideas that compliance personnel should consider and be doing in their day-to-day function. So firms should continuously seek to evolve and improve their trade and communication surveillance program. So as I already mentioned, technology has improved over the years, and we have seen some firms adopt new technologies. For example, 5 years ago, the technology for monitoring voice surveillance was very different and was not as viable as it is today. There have been recent improvements, so many firms now have automated voice surveillance. In addition, with AI and machine learning becoming more viable, these tools can look for patterns in communications and trading behavior instead of just looking at one transaction in a vacuum. This also helps to reduce the high number of false positives, helps to increase efficiency and effectiveness of these types of reviews. Another thing to think about are the benefits of having a QA process over surveillance. So not only will a QA process allow firms to improve technology over time, but it's really essential to perform QA in order to ensure that proper due diligence is done when addressing alerts. So we've seen cases when potential trading abuse was highlighted in an alert, but was missed because of insufficient due diligence or lack of proper expertise by the person reviewing the alert. Next area is a compliance testing program. So this is also valuable in identifying problematic areas, particularly when it comes to routine areas where issues are often identified, such as PTMM and record keeping. As we both already mentioned, trade reconstruction is an excellent exercise to address both of these areas. Another topic, metrics or KRIs. These are also very important when it comes to supervision. So obtaining metrics regularly to help assess compliance or having an operations department to monitor for various compliance with different rule areas. So for example, monitoring for active counterparties with outstanding counterparty documentation, monitoring for confirmations that were sent late, portfolio reconciliations which were not done within the required frequency, or even SDR exceptions. So you can confer with your colleagues in other departments to obtain this type of information and monitor compliance holistically. Another key point are internal audit reports. These should be regularly reviewed for relevant findings, especially the regulatory-related issues. Firms also need to be monitoring that they're doing the periodic testing that's required by the rules. So think about the annual test of the risk management program, the annual and triannual test of the business continuity and disaster recovery plan, and also the periodic audit of swap trading relationship documentation. So these are all very clearly defined requirements, which may result in a technical violation if they're not done on time. So it's really important to establish proper ownership so that people remember to get these things done to avoid these types of violations. So to conclude here, we really believe that if all of these different types of monitoring activities are being performed and the results are being properly escalated, issues should be identified early on, and there should really be no surprises when it comes time to compiling annual reports. So that concludes our prepared remarks. We're happy to take any questions at this time.
Hi. As a non-U.S. swap dealer, how the CFTC has bifurcated the U.S. person definition in their 2013 guidance versus the 2020 cross-border rule. The question is, for NFA's audit or examination purposes, do you consider different U.S. person definition for different rules?
I don't think we consider them different necessarily. I think the only area where we are really looking for those sorts of fine distinctions is going to be in guaranteed affiliates. But if I, at least in my exams, we're not really parsing that U.S. counterparty as much.
Yeah, I think that's also like a more recent update, so we haven't run into it much yet as part of our examinations. But I would say taking the more conservative approach would probably make more sense to classify them as U.S. persons.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's just difficult for non-U.S. dealers because for, you know, Fed purposes, they also have a different U.S. person definition. So we have to consider for reporting, for clearing, for and margin, three sets of U.S. person definitions, basically. Just something for regulators to consider.
Understood. Yeah, I would just go back and say once again, like to be more conservative, I think it would be safer to classify and treat them as U.S. persons than to try to keep track of who may or may not be.
Two questions. I agree with that trade reconstruction is an excellent exercise, and I believe that they are required to perform one in 72 hours. But, if you were to examine trade reconstruction, would you consider a dealer to do two or more trade reconstructions a month? Would it be a good control to have?
Yeah, absolutely. When we were mentioning trade reconstruction, we weren't necessarily talking about in the context of us requesting it as part of our exam, but we mean like as an exercise, the firm itself to be conducting them as a practice.
Okay, thank you for that. And I know it's too early, but CFTC rewrite took place, and when it comes to SDR reporting, do you have any information that you see so far that you want to share with us? As far as effectiveness, new mistakes, errors, or what have you?
It literally just kicked off, so we don't really have a lot to share with you. Hopefully in the next member workshop we will. But, you know, we know that firms are reporting instances to DMO, so, you know, it's happening. I really don't have much more to share at this time. I don't know. How about you, Corey?
Only to reiterate again that we are going to be looking closely at that reconciliation process and the reporting to DMO.
Hi, so for portfolio reconciliation, you talked a little bit about the reconciliation of material terms and valuation discrepancies, and at the end you mentioned one more either issue or better practice. Would you mind repeating that final point?
Well, it must not have been that important if I can't find it in my notes.
Was it
related to the swap dealer to non-swap dealer? Oh, that was it. So essentially, understanding again that counterparties aren't often engaging in this operation, but that the swap dealer's responsibility is to make sure the counterparty is aware what the swap dealer is relying upon for portfolio reconciliation. So it can't be simply, oh, well, we gave them their customer statement business as usual. There needs to be something to indicate that that rule area is being met or what the firm's relying upon to meet that obligation.
Hi, yeah, just a very quick question on the error correction notification form and the NFA's involvement during audits going forward with how they're going to be testing that. Do you have any idea or any sense of what you're looking for in terms of evidence of our particular concern is how we determine when we have made a determination that we can't correct something in 7 days, which, you know, for anything that's going to require development or is systemic, it's almost never going to be a 7-day turnaround. So, but we, you know, collegially make that determination. Do we need to record a timestamp of that? I mean, do you have any sense of what you're looking for in terms of evidence of compliance with that requirement?
Well, I think what we're looking for is a reasonable effort. I don't think with when the new rule areas come out, we aren't out there to play gotcha. We're looking for just a reasonable determination or a basis for when you report it or not. I know that's not too helpful, but you should find your exam team reasonable in this regard.
Hello. With regard to the verification process, the previous NFA exams really heavily focus on the specific element and verifying it through the NFA. Now, I think with the new rules, the ask is for the firms to do that. Does that mean that the NFA will focus less on trade reporting and rely that the firms are doing that? And if they're not doing that, will the NFA then kind of revisit their older model where they're actually looking at the elements themselves?
Yeah, so I think that depends on how useful we find your verification to be. You know, there is an element of our own testing that we will continue to be doing, and if we see that there are gaps between what we found and what your verification is finding, then that would bring us to do more testing. So it'll really just be done on a case-by-case basis.
Question about portfolio reconciliation and management of disputes in the variation margin process. Do you see them as a different processes? Because at the end of the day, counterparties that are financial entities or financial end users, you need to have variation margin CSAs. And at the end of the day, my team, the operations team, they do the review of the margins and management of the margin calls and disputes, and as part of that, they need to reconcile the portfolio. So, do you expect to have two different processes, or that will work to support both obligations?
So, as long as one process is meeting the requirements of both rule areas, it could be a single process.
Yeah, hi. I just had an additional follow-up on valuation discrepancies, and you were talking about the 10% or greater differences, and also the setting of thresholds, maybe setting of dollar amounts. I was wondering if you could just elaborate a little bit more on that. And I think some firms have maybe had heard in the past from NFA that maybe setting some thresholds was acceptable. So I was wondering if you could go in a little more detail on that.
So in determining how serious the discrepancy is, or I guess how to risk rate it, I think thresholds make sense. But if the thresholds are such that there are 10% discrepancies that aren't being identified or followed up on, I think that's where there's going to be a problem. So if a prior exam team saw that there was a threshold amount that triggered some additional action but wasn't excluding those discrepancies that we're looking for, I think that would be acceptable. So it's not that they don't have any place, but that they can't be to the exclusion of valuation discrepancies that should be followed up on.
Thanks. Corey, I think you made the comment that when a salesperson provides a PTMM, you tend to look into verifying the accuracy of that. Do you have the same level of focus when it's a trader that provides it?
No, this is something that, again, it has to do with, I guess, the salesperson's ability to, or I guess how closely they are to identifying the pre-trademark. So if a trader is feeding that information right to the salesperson, then and they're repeating that, that's low risk. And we wouldn't expect necessarily that to be an area of concern. It's when the salesperson actually has some control over what pre-trademark is being delivered that we would see that as a higher risk area.
Thanks, and just a quick follow-up to that. When the trader is providing it, or when the trader is providing it to the salesperson to provide it to the client, if they're doing so based on what they see to be the market, so all different types of publicly available pricing sources, is that deemed to be acceptable, or do you need to have some sort of record of that? So say if you ask, 6 months ago you traded this, you provided this PTMM, how did you know at the time that was accurate? Is that something you would need evidence of, or is it fair to say they had sight of the market at the time?
So we are testing on our own valuations of pre-trade marks to determine whether a clean mark was given. In those circumstances, we'll typically use one of our data sources. Sometimes when we found a variance that seems to us material, we go back to the firm to say, can you explain this to us? At that point, the explanation, the firm needs to have enough information about where the trader got that mark to be able to provide us with an answer.
All right, thank you.
I have a question. You mentioned that repeat findings is a factor you look into when determining whether it's a diligent supervision issue. So I was wondering, how do you determine what factors do you look at to determine whether it's a repeat issue, especially with issues like trade reporting, which is not inconceivable that you may have trade reporting exceptions every finding. Do you look at the root cause, or is it just at the rule level?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it really, once again, that's to be determined on a case-by-case basis, because an area like trade reporting, we understand that there could be various types of issues. But so I think all of that would be taken into consideration. It wouldn't necessarily mean that we would view that to be a repeat finding, just because it's in the same like general rule area. So we will sort of look at the root cause and look at what types of remediation the firm has been, you know, trying to do on the previous examination. So all of these things have to be considered in order to determine whether we label something as a repeat finding.
Though I will say, and I'll take failure to deliver pre-trade mark as an example. So if on one exam, NFA found that there was a problem, say, with a trading platform or a customer-facing platform where there had been an issue with the pre-trade mark. And then in the following exam, we found where maybe there was a problem with voice-delivered pre-trade marks. That would be considered a repeat finding, but the initial notification would be we would expect the firm to be looking more broadly to make sure they're not putting just Band-Aids on the actual problems we identify.
Are there any other questions? No? All right, perfect. Well, we're right on time, and that's going to conclude our final session. Just some quick notes before we wrap up. I appreciate everyone's attendance today. I hope you found it engaging and learned something new. Again, I encourage you to connect with the NFA staff should you have any other additional questions. All the materials, again, were emailed to attendees yesterday, so if you want quicker access to it, please check your email, but we'll have recorded sessions for the archived materials, I should say, available in the next week or so on NFA's website. And again, that's available to everyone, so please be sure to share that with your colleagues. Ron mentioned it earlier. We have our NFA Town Hall webinar coming up. That's a virtual webinar open to all members. So keep an eye out on your email for that. And again, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to NFA staff or the NFA Information Center is always a great resource. The contact information is on NFA's website. So thank you again for everyone joining us today. Safe travels home, and then, we'll see you again later next year.